CoinWorld Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about CoinWorld Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast with your host, Jeff Stark.
And as I've said from day one of this show, this is a big tent hobby. There's a lot of room for folks.
And Larry Jewett.
And learning has been such a tremendous amount of this journey.
The CoinWorld Podcast.
The CoinWorld Podcast is delighted to be back with you for another episode. I'm Jeff Stark.
I'm Larry Jewett. And boy, is 2023 turning out to be a really, really busy time. It's incredible out there.
Oh my gosh. It seems like I'm sort of, it's all I can do to stay abreast of all the happenings every day. Feel like I'm paddling furiously to stay above the waterline. But hopefully we're giving you a good little break here every week with the episode and keep you updated so you don't have to feel that way, and maybe as we do.
Yeah, well, I mean, and everybody is busy, and that's why we're thankful that you take the time out of your busy schedule to be a part of our community here with the CoinWorld Podcast. And thanks to everybody who's contributed to help make this as strong as it is right now as we're rolling along. I can't wait till that magic 200th episode, which is coming up here very soon. But you know, one of the things, it comes down to it, when you're involved in something for a period of time, then you start to find that you're seldom surprised by developments that occur. And, you know, it's almost to the point now where we hear about $1 million coins, and there weren't as many before, but now it's almost like 13 last year, over $1 million, already 10 so far this year. And it's almost like, you know, it's not a surprise these days. But I'll tell you, there's been some things that have just happened recently that I was totally surprised by. And one of those was covered in on, we had the online story a couple of weeks ago, and it was covered in William T. Gibbs' editorial here. I am totally blown away at the fact that the American Numismatic Association had to extend the deadline on summer seminar scholarships, because that's something that, how often do we hear someone say how important summer seminar has been to them, and, you know, how much it's helped them in their career, helped them in their business, whatever the case may be. And there are opportunities out there for individuals to get these scholarships, not just young people, but there are opportunities for people to get these scholarships, and they're not exactly beating down the door. So that's why the ANA has extended it, getting additional opportunities for those of us who might be able to take advantage of it. That surprises me.
Yeah, I am. Man, I wish I could apply for that. I'd love to go to seminar. I hear so many great stories out of it. And I have some friends that have been there, both as students and instructors. And it's just a good old time. So if you're listening and you haven't considered it, maybe you should, because Coin Camp, as people lovingly call it, is unlike anything else, I'm told. And you know, even my beloved Missouri Numismatic Society, I this year became eligible to be a life member, and so I've joined that as a life member. The MNS grants scholarships for summer seminar, and I think, you know, there are many organizations, as you say, besides the ANA, that do this to help encourage folks to go deepen their appreciation and understanding of the hobby. And it's a hobbyist of all ages. It's not just young numismatists, the YNs. That's certainly an important area, important group, but this is open to everyone. And by golly, if you can make it out there, you should. So that's a good reminder, because,
yeah.
You know, I do look back with some, I don't want to say chagrin, but regret, or what, you know, I didn't know about all the different opportunities when I was coming up in the hobby, because I just picked up CoinWorld at the library and a couple other magazines on the newsstands. And I didn't have that institutional support. Wasn't going to a club. I only went to one coin show before I came to Coin World. I knew I loved the hobby and was very involved, interested in it, but I didn't have that exposure. And so if there's a way to get that exposure, especially to have a more than passing interest, people should take advantage of that.
The thing that I really strikes me, because you just can't say this enough, is how many podcast guests in the 180 plus episodes that we've had that have had the opportunity to be a part in some way of the summer seminar and the impact that it has had on there. I mean, many of them didn't realize the extent of the impact that it would have until they actually experienced it. And so for people to get the chance to experience it, I certainly think that's an opportunity, a golden opportunity out there. So, I mean, I think we're likely going to have future podcast guests that have been impacted by the summer seminar.
Absolutely. And our guest this episode, Mark Hotz, was a young numismatist and summer seminar attendee and summer seminar instructor. So, the effect of summer seminar is felt far and wide and deep and high in the hobby. So that is, hopefully this is just a blip thing as people are getting back accustomed to quote unquote normality after a global pandemic. Where I definitely last year and this year, shifting into, it was so great to be back to Berlin, first time in 3 years. It felt like it feels like old times again, if you will, with maybe a deeper understanding and appreciation for the chance to gather. So maybe that will be the case this year.
Well, certainly. We invite you to check out the ANA website at money.org to find out more information about it. If you're unfamiliar with the summer seminar and you think it's, oh my God, it's 8 hours of classroom, it's more than that. It's more that you get opportunities. There's field trips, there's plans. I mean, there's the informal gatherings that are part of it when folks sit down to break bread and talk with other, collectors or business people or, experts in the hobby, authors. My goodness, the list just goes on and on. So we invite you to check that out too. One other ANA related item, which is coming up in the pages of our Coin World here, and that's Paul Jilks has reported on this, is for those of you who are going to be attending ANA shows in the future, the organization has taken positive steps in the direction of security. And not going to read you the story, but certainly the idea that you can breathe a little easier when you go to shows now, because they have gone proactive on doing their part. And, time will tell here. Numismatic crime is a real deal. It's happening all over the place, that not just at shows, but, just the idea that the organization is taking a positive step forward to meet the problem head on. And I commend them for that.
Absolutely. So now that we've sort of, I don't want to say dispensed, but now that we've explored what's happening today, I want to go backward in time. It's always instructive to look back in the past and find out what was happening back in the day. And this week in numismatic history, something really fun jumped out to me. What was happening on February 18th, 1959? That was when the Commission of Fine Arts received a critical review of the new Lincoln Memorial cent design, of course, 1959. Was the year that debuted. Who was criticizing the design? This was from the National Sculpture Society president, Adlai S. Hardin, not Stevenson, Hardin, Adlai Hardin, who called the change from the original wheat cent design an act of desecration. I hardly look at the memorial cent design and think of desecration, but it is interesting to note how at least one person viewed that. The wheat design is iconic, but now, almost, 60, 70 years on, the memorial design seems iconic as well. I don't know. It's it's what I'm used to. I don't know that I have a preference one way or the other. They both have things about which to be pleased. And, you know, it's in one sense, oh, it's just a building, or, you know, it's just a monument. Well, the other thing, it's just a couple of weed ears and words in the middle. So I just had to chuckle reading that, that little moment in numismatic history.
Yeah, I mean, it, for me, it was the memorial scent was one that's a lot of my lifetime here. And I mean, obviously, I was very young when the changeover was made and didn't have much experience with the weed ears. The weed ears became the quest. You wanted to find that. But as far as from the aesthetic standpoint, I think it's more indicative of what Abraham Lincoln stood for than what the previous design had on the reverse. I mean, I am personally... I have no objection to the shield, and but I still, you know, I find a warmer, softer spot in my heart for the memorial design. So it would be a desecration to me is too strong of a word for something like that. It's just a design, people get over it.
Yeah,
so.
For sure. anyway, it's one of those things that at least, you know, you can look back in retrospect and get a better understanding for how things were viewed at the time. That's also why we love looking at this week in Coin World history and looking at the February 18th, 1976 issue. I can't help but zero in on the two main stories on the issue. The top story is headline Ford names 76 assay commission. Now, this is then President Gerald Ford referring to the 1976 Assay Commission membership. The Assay Commission doesn't exist anymore. It was first established in 1792 and was one of the oldest institutions in the annals of American history. The first commission was appointed to make certain that the new national mint was handing out full weight coinage. It's really mirrored on or patterned after the British trial of the Picts that began in the 13th century. The idea was we wanted to make sure that the coins were legitimate, full weight, struck as the law mandated, all that. And so they would pull off a small number of coins from each batch, separate them all out, and then run a test of them, make sure they were good. What's curious to note is looking at the name of the members of the 1976 commission, a few names leap out at me. Harvey G. Stack, Roslyn, New York. Henry G. Spangenberger, Clayton, Ohio. Spangenberger was very much involved with the, I believe, Tokens and Metals Society. Another name that jumps out is Neil McNeil, Silver Spring, Maryland. I believe this is the Neil McNeil who wrote the book on presidential inaugural medals. Harvey Stack, of course, of the coin firm with you know, his last name, the family business. What's curious about this is the Assay Commission, we'll lead to this a little bit later, I guess. Maybe I'm going to do a trivia question based on the Assay Commission. How about that? So that was the lead story. Then the second story was mint hints at new denomination and smaller dollar. Well, the new denomination did not happen. This the story suggested that the U.S. Mint, the nation and coin collectors may have a smaller dollar size coin in an intermediate denomination between the cent and the nickel, Congress learned late last month. This was based on a report from acting director of the Mint at the time, Frank H. McDonald. We know in hindsight, in retrospect, that that intermediate denomination did not happen, but the smaller dollar would come just 3 years later in 1979. I should note 1976 was chosen this week because that was the year that our guest, Mark Hotz, was YN of the year. So that's what jumps out to me. What are you seeing on the letters page to comment on, Larry?
Well, there was a large letter concerning Eisenhower dollars, but I mean, that was something that would be of interest, but the one that really struck my interest was one called Classic Designs Urged, and that really follows along with what you cited for our This Week in Numismatic History here. And it said, Russ Hurd recommends removing the portraits of Lincoln, Washington, and Jefferson from our coins. I am wholeheartedly in agreement and favor returning to classic designs on all of our coins. Lincoln has been on the scent since 1909, at that point, 67 years. Washington since 1932, Jefferson since 1938, and Roosevelt since 1946. What portion of our population has known any design on the scent other than Lincoln? My admiration for the 16th president is second to none, but this does not mean his image on the scent must go on forever. There is nothing so sacred about anyone or anything that is immune to change with time. The coinage laws provide that when the same design has been on a coin for 25 years, the Secretary of the Treasury may change the design without authorization from Congress. Obviously, our politicians, both elected and appointed, do not have the courage to make a change once a popular figure is portrayed on a coin. It is for this reason that I recommend returning to classical designs on our regular coinage. There is nothing wrong with substituting the regular coinage with an occasional commemorative piece, like the Lincoln, Washington, and Jefferson coins were intended to be, or a memorial similar to those of Roosevelt, Kennedy, and Eisenhower pieces. These changes, however, should be designated in advance for specific periods, such as 1, 2, 5, or a maximum of 10 years. We went halfway on the bicentennial commemoratives this year. Canada and other countries have been doing this for years without any major problems. Why can't we get out of the coinage rut? That was from C. Edwin Aldrich of Alpine, New Jersey. And of course, times have changed a bit since then. I mean, we've gone through on the reverses of the quarter dollar with the American women. We've done the same thing on the reverses with the 50-state program, the America the Beautiful program. We've even gone to the point where we changed the obverse now on the quarter. But, you know, there is some point there. And it just kind of reminiscent of what the criticism was made about changing from the wheat ears to the memorial design. Change is good sometimes. Change is not good other times. I mean, obviously, this was a matter that was in 1976. And still, some of these elements are for consideration now. I personally kind of wonder why there's no activity on the dime. I got an old looking dime just in change last night, and I went, oh, wonder what this is. And well, it was only a 1992. It was just in bad shape, but it was the Jefferson nickel that got my attention because it was from 1964. And I got that in change last night, a 59-year-old coin in change. So there you have it. I mean, if we had a different look on the nickel, which we did for a while with the westward journeys and that type of thing, then that coin would have a little more of a panache, and so it's like, huh, this is interesting. But again, just they're just designs, but it's interesting what your views are and what emotions that they can elicit. So that's where that letter drew my attention.
Awesome. So now that we've looked at the This Week in Coin World History, I want to put you to the test. It's time for trivia. Last episode, I keyed in on 2006 because that was the year that the World Money Fair moved to Berlin. And I asked you what series of coins debuted at the show, and what's the theme of this series, and what was the first coin from the series. You've had a week to look this up, to think about this. Do you have any idea the answer to the questions?
Well, no, I really don't really have. I mean, that wasn't the I thought about the euro, and I that's not it at all. I mean, just I really couldn't come up with anything that I really would have a good answer for. And so, you know, it just went into the back of my mind and then went down whatever drain the back of my mind contained. So I really don't have anything for you today.
All right. So in 2006, Germany launched its series of circulating commemorative 2 euro coins. The 2 euro denomination is worth about $2.20 US at present. And it's been as high as like 250 and as low as $2. So $1 to $1.25 per euro is where the denomination has fluctuated in exchange value. The coin is the only denomination across the eurozone that can be modified. Originally, it was once a year. Now it's twice a year. The issuing countries can issue special designs commemorative of themes that are supposed to be of eurozone importance, although in many respects, they're more nationally important to the issuing country and not something of, you know, broader impact. There's something like 400 plus different designs now in that denomination. So this particular series of coins that Germany launched honors each of the federal Bundesländer components. That's like a state. It'd be analogous to a state. And I want to say there's 18 or 16, 16 of them. And the first state or Bundesländer so honored was Schleswig-Holstein. Say that three times fast.
Three times fast.
Okay. No, you're supposed to say that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. See, I can't even get that part right.
Anyway, and the series just concluded last year, 2022. So that was 16 years of issue. And they're starting a new series this year. All of that's been covered in the pages of Coin World in the European Report by my good friend Sebastian Wyszkowski, I better say that three times fast. Mm-hmm. And who was a co-author of a new book about the 2 euro commemoratives as well that launched at the show. So that's fun. It kind of all works together there. And I have many of these coins. I certainly don't have a full collection, though I'm trying. I picked up another dozen or so while I was in Germany. But at that rate, I'm never going to catch up because they're issuing, you know, 30 of these a year or whatever. It's there's quite a parade across the eurozone, that is. So we talked about the Assay Commission in the this week in Coin World history, and it got me thinking. I remember early on in my time at Coin World being aware of this group about which I'm going to ask. There's a group related to the Assay Commission. And this group actually issued medals. What's the name of this group? And when did the group fold? When was the last gathering of this group? They used to be found at ANA conventions. In fact, they would meet annually, but time is such that it was. The commission was, public members were stopped being added in 1977, and the Assay Commission was disbanded in 1980. So just, you know, use that as your guide, perhaps, and think about that. I know this, you know, we talk about national banknotes with Mark Kotz coming up here in just a second. We don't obviously get into Assay Commission stuff, but I thought that was a good subject to explore. Because of the timing with the reference in Coin World history. So there you have it. Think about that till next episode. In the meantime, there is the interview with Mark Kotz, and here that is. The Coin World podcast is delighted today to be joined by Mark Kotz, author of Hots Off the Press, a column in Banknote Reporter. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Hey, you know, it was just one of these things where I thought, who have we not talked to that we should talk to that has interesting experience and insight? And you were one of the names that came to mind. Certainly, your experience in the national banknote realm made it, you know, made you, I think, a worthy candidate. For those who don't know, Hots Off the Press is a sort of column/travelogue exploring national banknote history and modern day tourism. This is in the Banknote Reporter. How long have you done that column?
I've written for Banknote Reporter for 25 years, but it hasn't always been this format. When I first started with them, I was writing about things that were in my collection or general trends on the market. And then at some point I had gotten entry into the Smithsonian Institution, into their back rooms. And so I was able to see a lot of the paper money that was there, as well as the national banknote proofs. And I was writing about those. And then by chance, one time I just decided to write about a national bank that was nearby and with old photographs, and that sort of was appreciated. So I just decided to stop doing the Smithsonian stuff because Peter Huntoon was doing that, and it was also more difficult for me to get there, and just concentrate on what I've been doing since then, which is this basically going to smaller towns, or at least visiting smaller towns, finding the old banks, finding an old photo, finding some notes, and then, you know, talking about the bank, history of the bank, comparing photos and a little bit of information about the towns. And that's pretty much what I've been doing. And that's probably been about 20 years or 21 years of that.
Okay. I know that as long as I've been at CoinWorld, we got Banknote Reporter in the office, and I'd flip through there and see your stuff. And it was like, that's an interesting twist on, you know, highlighting the hometown nature of these quote unquote hometown notes. But before we go down that path, I want to comment that you were the ANA Outstanding Advisor in 2003. You were also a Young Numismatist of the Year. I don't know what year, and maybe you don't want to say what year.
It was 1976, I think.
Okay.
Something like that. Yeah, I was the Outstanding Young Numismatist then, and I did get that other award. I used to go to the summer seminar every summer for some time between about 1997 and 2006 or so. And I was teaching some classes on paper money, and I was a YN chaperone. So that was where that other award came from.
Yeah. So you have a long record of service to the hobby. How did you get into the hobby? Because you obviously didn't start with national banknotes. That's not something somebody picks up as, you know, in their beginning journey.
No, that's true. I actually started when I was a kid. I had an uncle who was interested in coins, and he gave me some old coins about when I was about seven. And I think the whole historical aspect of it, I think I really liked. I don't really remember all the details at that time, but eventually I got into some people gave me some ancient coins, some ancient Roman coins. And I really liked the idea of it, the concept that something that I was holding was had all that history in it. That concept, that old platitude, history in your hands, I think was very valid for me. So that's sort of how I got involved in it. The more historical it was, the more interesting it was to me. I started off like everyone else, you know, putting pennies in the Whitman folders, but I got bored with that very quickly because all that was filling holes. And I wasn't the kind of person that really was that interested in completing sets of things. I was more interested in going off on tangents and learning about different areas of history. So that's where how I got into numismatics. And then it was later that I got into paper money and into national banknotes.
Do you remember what that beginning was? How did you make that leap? Was it a mentor in a local club? Was it a chance encounter at a shop or a show? What, you know, was there a pivotal moment, a Paul on the road to Damascus, or, you know, whatever the, you know, the superhero change moment that set you on that path?
I actually had become a coin dealer at that point. I was doing a lot of shows, and I noticed, first thing I thought, paper money in general was attractive, but I also noticed that there weren't that many people that knew that much about it compared to coins. So if you would go to a show and you were running around in the beginning of the show where you were setting up trying to get good deals off people, everybody was looking for the coins, and not that many people were looking for paper money, or they didn't seem to know a lot about it. And I happened to become friends with a couple of guys who were setting up also, who had a lot of paper money. So I had already learned some stuff from them and began to realize that, you know, there was opportunities with paper money. As far as national banknotes were concerned, my uncle, the same one that got me started with the coins, happened to be a person that collected obsolete currency and national banknotes from Maryland and had one of the largest collections. And I had seen his collection over time, but had not necessarily become interested in it until later, when I began to feel it was, you know, find it was very interesting that all these various small towns and banks had issued all these notes and that there was a certain charm to them. And I just think that I was a person that liked the concept of small towns and small town history, and found the national banknotes in their geographical interest to be something that appealed to me. It was also around that time. And also you have to bear in mind that this is back in the around 19, late 80s, maybe early 90s. There was hardly any information. There was very limited information as to what was really good. There was only one, the Kelly catalog was very much in its infancy. It didn't have actual values for each note. It had a concept of a premium value over face value. And there was statistics that could be, there was a lot of information that if you really knew what you were doing, you could figure it out, but everybody didn't know. And it was an opportunity where you could buy a lot of better notes from people who really didn't know what they were. And I think I like that concept of it. It wasn't quite as competitive as some of the coin areas.
So for listeners who may not have a familiarity, I don't want to get too far down the road without explaining, and I'll ask you to do it. You know, give me the elevator speech version of what a national banknote is and how they came to be, if you would.
Sure. The concept there was that during the Civil War, the Union thought that the war would be over in 3 months and that it wouldn't cost that much and that they could just pay for it. And the problem was we didn't have at that time any kind of circulating national currency that was used in the country. We had a lot of coins, but we didn't have in the way of any paper money because people didn't trust paper money, and all the paper money that existed was privately issued by private banks or train companies or insurance companies and that sort of thing. When it turned out that the war was not going to end in 3 months, the problem was the government didn't know how to finance the war, and they only had a limited amount of legal tender notes that were allowed to be spent, and that was passed by Congress with a very limited issue. So they had to come up with a way to get people to buy government bonds that paid interest, and the bonds would help the government finance the war, but there wasn't any way to get people to do this. And so what they came up with was a scheme that actually was devised by Salmon P. Chase, who was the Secretary of the Treasury under President Lincoln, who had been governor of Ohio and had set up something in Ohio similar to this, where the idea was that all these private banks would be encouraged to join a national banking scheme where they would get to use the term national bank in their name, and they would buy government bonds to support their bank. And with as a result of that, they would be allowed to issue currency up to 90% of the value of the bonds that they bought. And the bonds would be deposited with the Treasury. And the Treasury would print this money with each bank's name on it. And the banks then could use the money to make loans in their local area. So it would be a double benefit for the banks. The banks would not only get the interest on the bonds, but they would also be able to lend out this money that came with it and make money that way. The government would get all this money from the sale of the bonds to finance the war. And the currency would be a way for getting, of the national currency would be a way of getting more money into circulation. Because prior to this, the only way to get more money into circulation was to mine gold and silver. And that was not necessarily something you could do. You couldn't just speed it up. So lots and lots of these state banks then converted to national bank status over time. And then just about everybody was joining into this because it was a good deal for banks. And so we ended up eventually having over 14,000 national banks in the country during the time period that the national currency era was, which was 1863 till its end in 1935. And all of these banks issued a variety of different notes, banknotes, depending on what the series was at the time. So it's, and they were all hand signed in a lot of cases by local officials, local bank officers. So they have a certain hometown feel to them. They had the name of the town on them. And obviously some banks were a lot smaller than others. So some of them are much rarer than others. And it becomes a very interesting collecting venue.
And we'll get into that in a little bit, but you know, you reference the timeline, 1863 to 1935, that 72 year period. It straddles the change from large size to small size, but it also, you look at how the country was growing at the time. Are these predominantly issued by East and Midwestern banks? Are there, I presume Western issues are then exclusively rare, because you think about, you know, maybe when Oklahoma was settled and, you know, Montana and all these, you know, the westward expansion was sort of tying up in the late 1800s, early 1900s. It might be a lot easier to find something from Ohio than Montana or Wyoming.
That's true. Clearly, the larger the population in a given area, the more banks there were going to be. It had all to do with the setup of towns. So clearly, there's national banks in every state and territory. There were national banks in Alaska. There were national banks in Hawaii. There was even a national bank in Puerto Rico. So, and there was throughout all the states. But clearly, the Western states, to a certain extent, are going to be much rarer because there were fewer people and fewer banks. So a state like Nevada only had 16 national banks in the whole state. And so those are going to be, in general, a much rarer state to find notes from than, say, Pennsylvania and New York, which had, you know, myriad number of towns and loads of banks. At the same time, any big city is going to be much more common than any small town. So even in the West, you have places like San Francisco and Seattle and Los Angeles, which even then were fairly large places. And so those notes are not going to be rare, but the smaller towns will be. Of course, there's plenty of rare small towns in the East and Midwest also, but that's part of the fun of collecting, because we have information data on how much value of circulation in notes each bank issued. The banks didn't print the notes themselves. They ordered them from the Treasury. And the Treasury, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, would print them based on the amount of money that in bonds the bank had bought. And some banks bought a lot of bonds and some banks bought very little. And they sent the notes to the banks with the bank's names printed on them. Clearly, if a bank was a very small bank in a very small town and only issued a very small amount, very little, if any of that, is going to have survived. Whereas a large bank that issued millions of dollars worth of notes is going to be far more likely to have more of those notes survive. So like cities like New York or Pittsburgh or Philadelphia may have had as many as 50 different banks issuing all at the same time.
Wow. So that begs the question, I guess, do collectors focus on, you know, the large size notes seem to be, you know, rather artistic and exciting in that regard. Do collectors just focus on large size versus small size? Do they, you know, I'm from St. Louis. You know, it would make sense for me to focus on St. Louis and then to a larger extent Missouri. Why would I get into some of these others? How are people collecting these, and what parameters do they use given those realities?
Well, that's an excellent question. And actually, there are so many different ways to collect. Traditionally, it started out that people collected the area that they were from, either a county, a city, a series of counties, or often just one state. And that is the way many people collect today. Some people subset the state into a couple of counties, and that's fine. The only problem with that is that invariably it takes a long time. There's going to be a certain amount of extremely rare banks in any location. And what happens is over time you can get pigeonholed into it. You can find yourself where there's only three notes that you need and somebody has them, or they don't exist, and you know, you get bored. But that's how some people collect. Other people just collect interesting named towns, you know, Sinking Spring, Cotton Plant, Picture Rocks. There's all kinds of really interesting named towns around the country, and people like interesting names. Some people collect notes from places where their family members are from. Some people collect notes from places they were stationed in the military. Other people just like attractive notes. It doesn't matter where they're from. Or they only collect small towns or notes that just seem rare to them. Some people collect certain types of notes. There, in the large size notes, there were about three major type differences where they completely changed the appearance of the notes. Every 20 years, they were required to change the appearance of the notes. So some people only collect certain types of notes based on their appearance. And then there are some people that just collect small size notes. Even though you're quite correct that they're very standard in appearance, they're more plentiful. And some people just feel that it's easier to collect their state in small size notes, because that way they don't have to get some really impossible large size only issuing banks. there's just so many different ways to collect that that people can just do whatever they want. And nowadays, I think that people just like attractive notes. And there's a lot of people that will just buy a really attractive note from just about anywhere. The bigger the city, though, the more those notes tend to just be type notes. So for people that are collecting paper money in general, they would want an example of every type of national bank note because it goes into their type collection. Mm-hmm. And they would tend to pick notes from large cities because they're just type notes. They don't have any special value because of the location.
More readily available.
Correct.
So I guess we've explored what national bank notes are and how you can collect them and all that. I want to talk about your column a little bit, though, because, you know, you've literally hit the road to probably hundreds of thousands of miles to document these many small towns. What are some of the, right? I mean, and then what are some of the interesting stories you've uncovered? I certainly know you've explored the connection between, some famous bank robbers, Dillinger and all that. I mean, there's some neat local and even national history tied up in some of these national banknotes that were issued.
Well, that's true. In fact, one of the things that I did after some time is when I got interested in the bandits, the gangsters of the 30s, I then put together a set on my own of small size notes from the banks that Dillinger robbed and then wrote articles about that. As far as the column is concerned, in the beginning, I really could only visit a lot of towns that were within driving distance of where I was living, which was here in Maryland or in Pennsylvania and Virginia. And there were a lot of small towns that you could go see. And what I would do also was try and find vintage photos of some of these banks. And, you know, obviously in the beginning, the internet was not as full of material as it is now. So I was buying a lot of photo postcards and postcard views of old banks. And then I would try and go to those towns and see if the building was still there and try and take a picture from the same vantage point. A couple of times I drove to Colorado Springs for the seminar instead of flying and went to all kinds of towns along the way. That took me into Illinois and Indiana, Iowa, and places like that. So I saw a lot of interesting places and met a lot of interesting people and saw towns that most people would never go to. That's true. And, you know, a lot of these places were off the beaten path. But over time, I would get people writing in that wanted me to do articles on towns in their states. And a lot of these were not, I just wasn't going to their states. And what happened was I couldn't go to all these places myself. And so eventually when Google came up with a street view of places, I was able to actually pick towns either that readers were interested in or that I was interested in based on a note that I had or something, whatever. And you could actually go into the town, find yourself on a spot and literally drive through the town until you found the bank building. And then you could capture a picture of it. Hmm. So I was able to write articles about towns I'd actually never been to, because I was able to capture a picture of the bank, and then I would find an old picture, and then I would learn something about the town, which would give me information that I didn't know and also was interesting to the readers. And sometimes some of the bank buildings were so interesting looking or were in such a ruin, some of them were ruins or abandoned, that would incline me to then decide to go out and find a note from that town, which is a way I then started collecting notes from towns that I'd written about. Because some of them were really interesting. So I don't necessarily have to go to all the places. And also in the past, when I was going to places, it was sort of a crapshoot because I had no idea. I might go, 30 miles out of the way to some town only to find that the building had been torn down 40 years prior to that.
Yeah.
Now I would know that because if I'm driving through the town on Google Street View, I can oftentimes find where the bank was and it's not there anymore. Or it's been torn down and replaced with a modern bank that you have a drive through. And so I know it's not worth writing about that town. So I don't have to spend extra time going to places not knowing there's going to be something there.
I guess I wonder how many banknotes exist for towns that no longer exist. I mean, I think about here in Missouri where I am, there's this giant man-made Lake of the Ozarks, and there's, down in near Branson, there's Table Rock Lake. They literally wiped places off the map. Have you found notes from towns that are no longer present because of, you know, such economic and human activity?
Yeah, there's actually people that collect that way also, trying to collect ghost town banks. But that's kind of, first thing, that's a limited number, and some of those are quite rare, not necessarily because the towns aren't there. There are several towns, like, I'm not familiar with the Missouri ones, that could have to be researched, but I know that there's a town in North Dakota called Van Hook that was flooded to build a reservoir, and people are interested in that town. There's a town in Pennsylvania, it's very famous, called Centralia, which had a mine fire going on underneath the town, and the whole town had to be evacuated and torn down. And there's people after notes from there, and there's actual real ghost towns like Rhyolite in Nevada, where there's only one note known, and that was the Holy Grail for years, until one turned up just 3 years ago. And, you know, that was one that was searched for forever. There's other towns, Omimi in North Dakota, and another one, a couple in Texas, where the towns are now ghost towns. There's not existing anymore. So yes, there's certainly interest in those. And those towns tend to be very small towns, so they're, the notes are going to be kind of rare. And that would be an interesting collectible area, but those notes would be hard to come by. I think another one in Pennsylvania is Summerfield, where a reservoir flooded that town out. Sometimes the banks weren't all that small there, but the notes are in demand. So there's so many different ways to collect. And of course, some people collect notes. They look for famous signatures on notes. You know, people that ended up were bank officers, but were famous people, or ended up becoming treasury secretaries or things like that. There's a lot of different ways. Not to mention people who want to get notes that were signed by relatives of theirs.
That would be fun. So you touched upon a couple things there that bear further elucidation. You talked about the Rhyolite note, Nevada, and how there was 3 years ago another discovered. National banknotes, despite the, you know, there's all these great records because of the federal involvement. And so, you know, we know down to the number, you know, how many banks issued notes and all that, but there seems to be still some room for a lot of discoveries. Even though, like, when you started, there was an information shortage, it seemed like. You have folks like, you know, things like the Kelly Book, Peter Huntoon, the National Banknote Census. So talk about what's more to be discovered and how there are avenues of discovery. And then we can get into how somebody who's maybe interested in this can go pursue the resources that are out there.
Well, over that 70 some year period when national banknotes were in circulation throughout the country, and it's worth keeping in mind so the listeners would understand that a national banknote issued by some bank in a town in Missouri, you could spend it anywhere in the country. It was standard national money. You could take that note from Missouri and go to Maine and spend it. It was still, it looked just like any other bill. The only difference was the overprinted name of the bank that was responsible for it, so to speak. And nobody could ever lose money on a national banknote. No matter what happened to the bank, any of the notes that bank's name were on that were outstanding were still good money. That was the whole purpose behind the bonds. The Treasury kept the bonds, and if a bank closed voluntarily or was closed by the receiver because of bad management, any of the notes that were outstanding from that bank would be redeemed from when they sold the bonds at the end of that period. So the money, nobody ever lost any money on a national banknote. As a result, people didn't have much of an incentive to hold on to them. If you were living in the 19 teens or whatever, the 20s, and you wanted to save some cash, you were far more likely to keep gold coins than you were to keep bills, because, you know, gold was a real metal, and paper money was, you know, people didn't really trust it. So people didn't save money. And also, it was $20 or $10 in those days, or even $5 was a lot of money. So when the time came for the end of this period, you know, even though there'd been hundreds of millions of dollars circulating, in the end, less than 1% of the originally issued national banknotes are still existing. It's a very, very small percentage. Even though there's quite a few notes out there, it's a unbelievably tiny amount compared to the amount that was originally issued, which was redeemed and destroyed. You know, over time, the notes would be redeemed by banks when people would spend them, and then they would be destroyed. So there's a limited number of notes out there for people to collect. But yes, they are continuing to be discovered when Sometimes some of the bankers kept notes that they had their own signatures on. Some people kept the first notes that their banks issued. Other people stashed cash, especially during the prohibition period when they didn't want to put money in banks. So there's people that still find money stashed in parts of houses. There's some people that just find an old bill in the family Bible or in a book somewhere. So yes, the real fun things about it is you never know when new notes are going to turn up. And that's something that happens. And of course, we're always hoping, you know, that some new exciting note will turn up, and you know, that's part of the fun of it. You never know when something's gonna happen. Somebody brings some notes into a coin shop, you know, along with coins, or something turns up at an auction somewhere. But, you know, it's really a very much of a catch as catch can kind of thing. You never know what note's gonna turn up. You could find a group of notes. I've seen this many times where somebody had a group of notes that just their grandfather or great grandfather had stashed somewhere. And, you know, they might have 10 notes and almost all of them are really common, but there'll be one really good one in there. And it's totally by chance because the people that were stashing the notes away were just putting away money. They weren't thinking about where they came from. Nobody during that time was collecting. Very few people, let me say, could afford to collect national bank notes when they were actually issued, because it meant keeping a lot of face value and money. You know, most people couldn't do that. So it's really by chance what turns up.
So before we get into the resources, I do want to ask, it seems like given the hometown nature, given the, you know, the many ways these can be collected, though, you know, there's, I don't, this is not a bad thing, but it seems like there's a thin market for some of these in as much as that if you had another 10 collectors per state, you could really move the market. Is that a fair assessment, or is it, you know, depends on the state, or what is, you know, how could the needle be moved with a tiny action like that?
All right. Well, that's actually a very astute comment, because it's quite true. If there are several serious collectors for a state and a good note comes up, they'll probably fight over it. But once one of them gets it, the next one that comes up won't have the same competition for it. So that is true. And you're quite correct that more information about national banknotes will bring necessarily more people into collecting. Once people find out about this, and it's not really highly publicized, I mean, I really think that it would be good to have some national media coverage on this, like even in the Wall Street Journal or something like that. But once more people become interested and start collecting, there are a limited number of notes. And once somebody starts collecting and they sort of get bitten by it, it's sort of like an addiction. Once you've collected and bought the commoner notes, you have to try and find the better ones. And there's a limited number of the rare ones, sometimes only one. And the problem is that a lot of the people that collect them won't sell them. They don't either need the money or they don't care. And so just because you have the money doesn't mean you're going to get the note that you want, because people tend to not sell them. It's not like a 1796 quarter. Those are very expensive coins. But if you want to buy several of them, you can buy several of them at any given time. They're out there. They're just expensive. In national currency, that's not necessarily the case. The people that have some rare notes often don't want to sell them, and it could be 20 or 30 years before it comes on the market. So clearly, for some people, if you're collecting a certain area, like I said in the beginning, you can get pigeonholed, which is why some people branch out into new areas. Well, I'm collecting this state, but until the stuff I'm looking for comes along, I'm also going to collect this or this or that, or I'm going to collect states that have cities that have three letters in their name, or I'm going to collect this county, a different county somewhere else, or this type or whatever. Some people collect notes from towns that are first names, like Arthur or Melvin or St. John's or George or something like that.
I could be Jefferson City.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's all kinds of ways to collect these things, but you are quite correct. If all of a sudden 10 new people that had serious resources or were at least serious about it came into a given state, that would put a lot of pressure on the notes from that state. And this has happened on several occasions where somebody came in and decided they were going to buy up everything from a given state, which they did, that was available. And then everything from that state became impossible for other people to get. But this doesn't last forever. States that are extremely popular can become really dead if a couple of major collectors die and stop collecting. states that were really dead, when I say dead, is they're not that much interest in, can become really hot if two or three people start buying the notes from that state. Seriously. So you never, it's one of those things. It's also one of those things where you have the only note and you're always worried that all the, you know, at some given, any given time, another note could turn up, which will then have the value of your note pretty much. So it's a risk. It can be a risky game if you're only in it for money. Most people that collect national banknotes are in it because it's really a chase.
It's funny you mentioned that comment about another one being discovered, because in the 2003 announcement from the ANA about your advisor award, you made the comment about moving away from ancient coins because, hey, the next thing you know, another hoard of 9,000 of these is being unearthed in Bulgaria. Of course, you're not going to find a hoard of 9,000 national banknotes, although that does beg the question. What were some of the large collections? You mentioned Huntoon earlier, and Don Kelly is a book. There's the Higgins Museum in northwestern Iowa, I believe. What are some of the big resources and famous collectors that folks today can look to for insights and all that?
Well, I just want to comment that you're quite right about the ancient coins when I said that at the time, and that's still true today.
Yes,
when you're collecting certain ancient coins, you never know when a huge hoard is going to come up. And recently, there was a huge hoard in Turkey of the Athenian owl silver. Silver tetradrachms, I guess they were. Those coins, were hard to come by in high grade, and they were expensive. And then they found several thousand of them, virtually all of them uncirculated. So you never really know with that. Obviously, that can make them available to more collectors, but it's kind of iffy you don't want that to happen. No, there haven't really been hoards of thousands of national banknotes, but there have been hoards, and hoards are where good notes come out of, not necessarily out of collections, obviously. So there have been hoards. There was a so-called Ella Overby hoard in Minnesota where this woman had stashed away endless amounts of money in nationals and made a couple of towns really common. Somebody in Cassopolis, Michigan, had put away virtually the entire half the circulation of small size notes and uncut sheets that they found in safe deposit boxes. So you never really know. There are some small towns that, if it wasn't for somebody sticking away 50 of the notes, the towns would be unbelievably rare. St. Paul, Nebraska, is one of them, where there's at least 50 of high grade Series 1882 notes, but if none of those existed, the town would be impossible. Another one is Shiner, Texas. So there's a certain amount of what we call hoard towns where, for whatever reason, somebody saved a whole lot of notes from one town, and so they become available when otherwise the town wouldn't be. As far as major collections are concerned, there are some fairly famous people. You mentioned Peter Huntoon, who collected for years Arizona and Wyoming and had major collections for those states. And Don Kelly collected Ohio, but also put together catalogs of information for everybody else so that people would know the statistics on national banknotes. The Higgins Museum obviously has a lot of notes from Iowa, Minnesota, and the surrounding states. And there's also other major collectors for various states whose names we're not get into, but there's people that collect a lot of different states, and some of them very seriously and some of them not as seriously. It's just that everybody's waiting for new stuff to turn up, and it's always interesting to see where it's going to turn up. eBay has been one of those places where, since its inception, national banknotes have just turned up in the most haphazard ways, where somebody who has no idea that they have anything at all will just post a national banknote on eBay and start it at $9, and it'll be worth $10,000 or $10,000, and other times they have notes that aren't worth anything. But that's where stuff comes from. It just comes out of what we call the woodwork, so to speak, a note that was in some drawer. That's part of the fun of it. Of course, it's the same with coins, except that it's very hard to track your coins. If there's a hoard of bust halves and they get disseminated, unless it says on a slab where it came from, it's just another bust half. But since paper money has serial numbers and has locations, you can always track where these things came from. A lot of people can trace some of their collectible notes back to the Grinnell collection, which was perhaps one of the, at that clearly up until recent times, the largest collection of paper money and national banknotes that had been collected by Albert Grinnell in the 40s and 30s. And that was sold in 1946 and 47. And a lot of those notes were identified by serial numbers. So people can trace the provenance of some notes in their collections back to that. And people like provenance. Obviously, if you can collect a note that was in some more famous collector's collection, that's always fun. It's nice. It's like with coins, where you can track them back, you know, quite some time and order famous people that own them. And that's always something fun to do. With regard to your question about information availability, unlike coins, which when I started out in coins, one of the advantages of being a dealer was if you knew more than everybody else. Now, with the advent of the internet and the fact that publishing has and self-publishing has become a thing when it wasn't, there are books on literally every obscure area of numismatics you can imagine. And the internet provides all this information, as it does for pricing. So it's very difficult for the average coin collector dealer to know something that everybody else doesn't know. Whereas with paper money and national currency in particular, there still is that aspect of knowledge that you can still have that everybody else doesn't have. There are catalogs, but the catalogs that we're using now, and they're mainly the various editions of Don Kelly's National Banknotes, A Guide, which has been out of print now for some years. I think there were about five separate editions. It's been out of print for some time, but that was and still is the Bible for national banknote collectors, because it provides every information on every bank by state, how much circulation was issued, how many types of each note, and how many of them are known, and how much currency was outstanding in 1935, how much had been unredeemed, and that sort of thing. And so you have an idea which banks are rare and which ones aren't. That's pretty good information. And now there is a good census that's been maintained by Andrew Shiva and Peter Huntoon, called the National Banknote Census, as well as other people that are doing it, where all the notes that are auctioned off by major auction houses are the information on their serial numbers and stuff are downloaded into a census, which one can subscribe to online. And that tells you how many notes are known by this census information for large and small type for every bank. That's also used for information. And of course, there's archive information from Heritage and Stax Bowers and Lynn Knight, where they have auction archives where you can look up and see if and when a note from a given bank has been sold and how often and what they sold for. That said, it's still an area like the Wild West where the information is not complete. The census is only a census of the notes that actually have been reported to the census. So there's lots of notes out there which are not reported, which might make some notes that seem that they're rare according to the census not as rare in reality. Some states are extremely well reported, like Nevada and Arizona and Wyoming, and other states are not well reported, like Pennsylvania and Texas and New York, where there's lots and lots of notes that are not known, are not reported, which might make some banks, like I said, look rarer than they are. The only real way to really know what you're doing is through experience. You have to look at a lot of national banknotes over time. And once you do that, like with me, I know in the states that I'm familiar with, which notes I've never seen. I know which notes are common and what banks I've never seen a note from. And Pennsylvania is one of those that I'm very well versed in. And if there's a note that I see at some show and I've never seen a note from that bank, even if it indicates in the census that some notes are around, it's a good note. Just because some notes are reported in the census does not mean that they're available. So I know some people that collect particular towns and will buy all the notes from those towns and won't sell them. And the census might show that there's 15 large notes known, but they're never available. That's a rare note. And that's some information that's worth considering.
Awesome. Well, you've given us a lot of information worth considering today. I want to thank you for your time and for the listeners for hanging in here, because this was, we covered a lot of ground, a lot of good insights. It's, you know, at Coin Club here last week, somebody mentioned you know, I don't see too many national banknotes here. That's what I collect. And I go, well, you know, this is an area that I need to delve into a little bit further. So I appreciate you taking the time to do that for us, with us today.
It's my pleasure. And I can just on a final note, I can say that if people talk to their local coin shop dealers, you go to any coin shop and you ask them how many national banknotes they've gotten in over the past 5 years, it's going to be a really small number. When it comes right down to it, coins are really plentiful and paper money isn't. And in paper money, national banknotes are even scarcer because they really weren't saved in large quantities. So it is a really interesting area to collect, and it's a fun area to collect. And I thank you so much for having me as your guest. I really enjoyed this. I love talking about national currency, and thanks again.
Thank you. That was our interview with Mark Hotz. Hotz Off the Press, all about national banknotes and travelogues and just fun stuff there. Really appreciate him taking time to speak with us.
There is no shortage of fascination that comes with that particular subject right there. I mean, I've said that before, that it's just like it's enthralling to me to talk about national banknotes like that. And I want to thank Mark for taking the time and the work that he does. Certainly, it's just definitely do appreciate all that he does right there. I mean, it gets you excited about another collectible possibility.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's we're never going to run out of topics and experts, hopefully, to talk about in this show, because there's just so much cool stuff out there. And we're going to keep working hard to dig up that good stuff and share it with you next time. But until then,
happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next week.
Coin World Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about Coin World Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.